The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. And welcome once again to the Free Library of Philadelphia. We have a very special program for you this evening, and I can't imagine what at least one of the questions is going to be about. But I'm delighted that all of you are here. As many of you know, I'm Elliot Shalcrott. I'm the president of the Free Library of Philadelphia, and it gives me a great pleasure to have Senator Arlen Specter here with us tonight. You know, his new book is A Passion for Truth. And in keeping with the book's title, I need to make just admit to something, a mistake, if you will. Inadvertently, in some of the material that went out, we gave the Specters credit for raising three beautiful daughters. Well, you know, I could say mazel tov, the truth of the matter is that they have two wonderful sons. At any rate, since the theme for this evening is a passion for truth, I wanted to apologize for that and clear the record. This Friday's Rebuilding the Future series, the featured speaker will be Ha Jin, National Book Award and Penn Faulkner Award-winning author of Waiting. Ha Jin will discuss his latest collection of stories, The Bridegroom, and some tickets for that are still available. So if you tickets are available through Upstages, and they're at 215-569-9700. I have some great news to report. I know some of you were with us this last Saturday night, but last Saturday was the sixth annual Borrowers Ball, and it was indeed a great success. The people who have told me, and some of them are here tonight, that they had a thoroughly enjoyable time. I can tell you that we had a record number of 590 guests at the library, and as much as we are interested in making new friends and meeting new people, and we want the evening to be exciting, the proceeds for the evening also exceeded last year by over 30%. And this additional money goes to our after-school programs for children, our LEAP program for children and teenagers. It goes to other programs, including a program for preschoolers called Books Aloud, whereby we work with daycare centers around the city, placing books in them and also helping the teachers, some of whom are not thoroughly trained, to understand various techniques in using books to turn the preschoolers on to reading and the joy and the excitement that are in books. I do want to issue one other invitation. On November the 17th, during National Children's Book Week, we'll be celebrating the grand reopening of our Haverford branch on Haverford Avenue. And, of course, that's in West Philadelphia. This is one of the large old Carnegie libraries. It's been a large project. It has taken us more time than we wish, but I am delighted that the grand opening will take place. And if you've not seen what we have done for neighborhood libraries, and if you haven't seen and felt the excitement of the community, please join us on November the 17th, and you can call our public relations office for that. You can call my office, 686-5300, and we will get you the information. Tonight we have a special guest to introduce Senator Specter, Marie Field. Marie has known the senator for a long, long time. Her family's ties with Specters have allowed her to see a side of the senator that's often obscured by the bright lights and the headlines and history. Marie is a former school teacher and a voracious reader. She's also a very active person with the library's George S. Pepper Society, a leadership council that helps to raise money for the library. Her advice, her effort to engage new members to join this Pepper Society has helped us raise the annual giving support over three times what it was several years ago. And having said that, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to the podium Marie Field.
I was up very late last night. Not only for the reason you are probably thinking of, but because I was doing my homework for tonight, finishing Arlen Specter's book, Passion for Truth. I recommend it wholeheartedly to those of you who may not have already read it. It is a fascinating chronicle of our times, written from the unique perspective of an observer participant. Arlen is a meticulous storyteller with a prodigious memory. His insider's view of historic events in Philadelphia and Washington are riveting, from the magistrates' trials to the Warren Commission investigations to the Bork hearings and so much more. But the book is also a personal memoir written as a labor of love, and as such gave me an opportunity to get to learn more about a very special friend. Joe and I have known Arlen for more than 40 years and have admired his brilliance, his integrity, and his enormous achievements, and have been grateful for his unfailing kindness and personal warmth. We participated in his early political campaigns and have watched with pride as he has become one of the Senate's most esteemed members. But until reading his book, I did not understand the motivating force behind his high aspirations and unwavering dedication to a long career of extraordinary public service. When I read Passion for Truth, I was reminded of the Chinese proverb, "A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step." In Arlen's case, his journey to Washington and his commitment to a good and decent government is really a continuation of his father's long journey, first when he stepped out of his home in the Ukraine and trekked across Europe on his way to America, and then when he wanted to go to Washington to correct the injustices done to the veterans of World War I. I also learned the reason behind Arlen's reverence for truth, the propellant energizing so many of his investigations and hearings. In his words, "Truth is the indisputable foundation for a decent, just, and civilized society." Tonight is actually Arlen's literary debut, the first time he is addressing a substantial audience as a published author. It's a perfect match. Philadelphia's Free Library and Pennsylvania's Senator Specter. Although born in Russell, Kansas, Arlen long ago adopted Philadelphia as his hometown. And although not a native son, he certainly has become our favorite son. I am honored and thrilled to introduce him to you.
Thank you very much, Marie Field, for those very generous words of introduction. Although I must confess I couldn't hear them where I was situated back until I broke the sound barrier, violated all the rules, and came onto the stage thinking that you would be saying very complimentary things. When I got here, I was right, so thank you. when it is represented that the Fields and the Spectres have been friends for a long time, it is true. Joe and I debated for Penn together in an era which I will not identify with particularity, and then went to the same law school and have been very close ever since. And Joan and Marie and Joe and I have been very close for, let's put it, decades. I'm delighted to be with you this evening in this very distinguished lecture series. I thank the Free Library for inviting me, and I thank all of you for joining us this evening. My book, Passion for Truth, takes up the essential theme that if people can agree on the facts, then it is a relatively easy step to decide what the public policy ought to be, which flows from those facts. And every person is entitled to his or her own opinion, but not to his or her own facts. And I have been very troubled from a very early age about the way the government treats the people. And that is why I have chosen government work as a career, to try to do something about it. My first exposure to the government came at a very early age. My father, an immigrant from Russia, literally walked across Europe when he was 18 to avoid going to Siberia under the Tsar's heel. And he came to America to find a life for himself. And he was proud to be in the American Expeditionary Force, where he rose to the rank of buck private. Some of you may not know that that's the lowest rank. I have occasion to speak with some frequency to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and those fellows all have 4 stars on their epaulets, and I cite my father's rank, which to my way of thinking is the highest rank. At any rate, the veterans of World War I were promised a bonus, $500, and my father certainly deserved it because he fought in the Argonne Forest, was wounded in action, carried shrapnel in his legs until the day he died, and the government double-crossed him. Government has a way of doing that, and doing it with impunity and getting away with it. But the veterans marched on Washington. Today, when there's a march on Washington, the government rolls out the red carpet. In those days, they rolled out the cavalry to chase the veterans down Pennsylvania Avenue, killing some of them. My father was not in the group because we lived in Wichita, Kansas, more than 1,000 miles away. And President Hoover called out the Army. Chief of Staff was a man named Douglas MacArthur. You may have heard of him. And his aide-de-camp was a major named Dwight Eisenhower. And the man in charge of the cavalry was Major George Patton. And the veterans never got their bonuses. And in a sense, I've been on my way to Washington ever since to get my father's bonus. That's a metaphor, really, for looking out after the interests of the little guys, and the country is full of them, guys like Harry Specter, who need someone to look after their interests. And in Washington, I have chaired the subcommittee which went into Ruby Ridge, which was a terrible fiasco where a deputy marshal was killed and Randy Weaver's wife and son were killed. And I know you'll want to find out all about what went on behind the scenes, and of course you have to either check the book out of the library, and there's a big waiting list, or you can buy one downstairs, and I'll sign it. They're worth $2 less after I've signed it, so you may want to take it without having a signature. But when we finish that investigation, The FBI changed their rules for use of deadly force. They had an approach to that siege which violated the Constitution. And it candidly takes the Congress to bring in the director of the FBI and read him the Riot Act and compel them to change their rules at the risk of having legislation do it for the FBI. I started as an assistant district attorney in Philadelphia and tried the Teamsters case. Nobody in this audience is old enough to remember the goon squads which terrorized the city of Philadelphia. And the investigation was conducted by a couple of guys named Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a senator in the mid-50s, and Robert Kennedy was general counsel for the McClellan Committee. And it was a hot potato, and I took on the assignment, and Robert Kennedy was convinced the case was going to be fixed because Philadelphia was so corrupt in those days. The Attorney General Katzenbach said in Philadelphia nearly half the people are on the take, and we sent them all to jail. And that followed with an invitation to be one of the younger lawyers on the Warren Commission staff. And I say younger lawyer because I'm still a young lawyer, but I was a younger lawyer then. And I better take off my watch to give the chairman a false sense of security that I'm paying attention to the time. But I really will, because I want to leave the maximum amount of time to hear your questions and specific points of interest. And working on the Warren Commission staff, my area was the one as to the wounds which were inflicted on President Kennedy and Governor Conley. And in the course of that investigation, on examining the facts, I concluded that a single bullet had passed through the president's neck and then had gone through Governor Conley. President Kennedy was hit by a subsequent shot, which hit him in the back of the head and was fatal. And for the past 36 years, I have been derided by all of the people who have sold a lot of books. If I sell a tenth of the books they've sold, Joan will be able to give up the pie business. She actually has given it up, but the essential facts are, and I'll be very brief about this, a bullet struck the president at the base of his neck. It was the first shot that hit him. Passed between two large strap muscles, struck nothing solid, sliced his pleural cavity, went through his pleural cavity, sliced his trachea, and exited from the front, nicking the tie. The tie was retained in a great loop because at Parkland Hospital, to give a tracheotomy, they sliced the tie first off, so the tie was retained, leading to one of the humorous vignettes in the book. Alan Dulles, former head of the CIA, was a commissioner, and I started to worry retroactively about Alan Dulles after working with him. And during the testimony of the autopsy surgeon, Alan Dulles fell asleep. And I was holding up the tie to show the trajectory of the bullet and where it nicked the tie, at which point Mr. Dulles suddenly awakened, and he said, "By Jove, President Kennedy wore a ready-made tie." When the expert produced some flakes which were metallic, this is not really the best of after-dinner conversation or any conversation any time, but we had to match up the flakes which came from the president's head with the ballistics as to what the evidence was. And there were two metallic flakes which an FBI agent had distributed and shown to all of the people who were listening. And when they came to Alan Dulles, he put his glasses up on his head like that, and his pipe in his mouth, and he leaned over, and he said, "There aren't two flakes here. There are four flakes." And the FBI agent at the end of the table who had produced the vial broke the modern speed record in getting to the vial, and he took two of the flakes in his fingers and crushed them and said, "No, Mr. Dulles, those are two flakes of tobacco which have fallen from your pipe." Well, not to overdo it, but the book is filled with funny little vignettes about what went on behind the scenes. At any rate, after the bullet nicked the tie, coming back into the sequence, Governor Connally was seated directly in front of President Kennedy, and the bullet entered slightly to the left of Governor Connally's right armpit, sliced a rib. He was sitting in the jump seat, tumbled through his wrist, and lodged in his thigh. And as you know, truth is stranger than fiction, but those are the facts. The critics derided the single bullet theory on the basis that the bullet hole was low down on the shirt, so that the bullet would have to have gone in and come up, the so-called Specter zigzag theory. It's the first time Joan laughed at that particular line. But the point is not where the bullet entered the shirt. The point is where the bullet entered the body. And President Kennedy wore a back brace, and he stood up in the car to greet the crowds, and he was waving, and the shirt rode up on him. So the trajectory was entirely consistent with the single bullet theory. Then there were metallic fragments at various levels of Governor Connally's wrist. So the critics have questioned whether this pristine bullet could have done all that damage. And when Dr. Gregory, the orthopedic surgeon, testified before the commission, and I questioned him, and he brought in the x-rays and said there are metallic fragments at various levels, I asked him the question, could this bullet have done that? And he said, yes, because these metallic fragments are so thin they're like postage stamps, and they can be attributed to the 3 grams which this bullet has lost in weight. So that the facts do stick together. I may have a convert in Angelo Cataldi. I want to judge this crowd's reaction to Angelo Cataldi. How many of you know Angelo Cataldi or have heard him? Well, that's a better representation than I thought. He's the WIP sports guy who comes on at 6 a.m., which is about the time I leave the house because Joan gets up at 5 and she's long gone and I have no alternative, so I flip on Cataldi, occasionally call in to commiserate about the Eagles. Well, he invited me on his program to talk about the book. And Cataldi was dead set against the single bullet theory because he'd gone to see the movie JFK and Mark Lane was his hero and all the rest of it. And now Angelo is neutral on the single bullet theory. And he's invited me back. So I looked for a convert in Angelo Cataldi. And I think if I can persuade Angelo, the sky's the limit. But on a very, very serious note, and what I've said to you is really serious, I thought it was very important to write it down, how the commission was formed, what we did. The commission did not want to take Washington lawyers in for concern that there might be an allegation of a cover-up if the lawyers came from the Department of Justice or if they came from inside the Beltway. So they went across America and they hired a lawyer from Des Moines and a lawyer from Cleveland and one from Los Angeles and one from Chicago, but two from Philadelphia. Bill Coleman and I were asked to join the Warren Commission staff. And we conducted the investigation. And Chief Justice Warren said, the truth is your client. I wanted that, by the way, for the title of the book, Truth is the Client. But Morrow and Harper Collins know more about marketing books than I do, I guess. And the title turned out to be Passion for Truth. But Warren said, truth is the client. And we had an attitude that if the single bullet theory was incorrect, so be it. We were going to follow the facts wherever they led. If Oswald wasn't the assassin, so be it. And after hearing criticism for 36 years, and wherever I go, the high school students are enraptured with it. So are the college students and the open house town meetings. believe it or not, senior citizens are a lot more concerned, some counties, with the single bullet theory than the Social Security system. That may be a slight overstatement, but I get a lot of questions about it. And I was with Chief Justice Warren when Ruby's deposition was taken, and that was a great event. Jack Ruby murdered Lee Harvey Oswald on national television, as I think most people know. And when the group was selected to attend the deposition, they decided to make the group as small as possible, so I was left out. I was the junior lawyer who attended the session. And in the middle of the deposition, Secret Service agent Elmer Moore came down and said, Arlen, Ruby wants someone in the room who's Jewish. Come on into the room. So not to be concerned about discriminatory identification, I went into the room. And I sat down, and Ruby looked at me and went, that's not going to come out too well in the transcript because they're going to use this for the archives where no one will ever listen to it. And then again he went, mouthing the words, are you a Yid, which is Jewish, a Jew, are you a Jew? And I sat there saying nothing because it's been transcribed. And I'd been chief of the appeals division of the DA's office, and I wasn't about to say anything. And fortuitously, at that point, the stenographer ran out of paper, and Ruby called Chief Justice Warren and me over into a corner. And there we had really a fascinating conversation. And in the interest of brevity and book sales, I will not tell you what the conversation... More in the interest of brevity than book sales. I will not tell you what the conversation was. And then I was the commission representative for his lie detector test. And Ruby denied being a part of a plot and denied being hired by the mob. And the expert polygraph examiner from the FBI said he thought Ruby was telling the truth when we rode back to Washington. Later, Director J. Edgar Hoover said that the polygraph should not be relied upon. And because of Ruby's mental condition. I think that was wrong, but we wrote it all up, exactly what Ruby said on the transcript, and we published the tracings so that 50 years from now or 100 years from now or whenever, people can look at the tracings and come to their own conclusions. But they are still talking about the assassination of President Lincoln 165 years later, and I believe that people will be talking about the assassination of President Kennedy for centuries. Who knows how long? And this is my effort to write it all down and say what we did and how we got there and what the real facts were. And there's been a lot of cynicism about that, and it's all there in black and white. Some of my activities have been focused in Philadelphia. About half of the book is devoted to what I did as district attorney and had the modern prosecutor's office and how we looked after victims' rights. And I was asked by the Philadelphia Inquirer in an interview a couple of days ago, what did I think was my major achievement? And my first answer was, I haven't gotten there yet. And they said, well, up till now. And I said, reforming Philadelphia's magisterial system. For those of you old enough to remember, they were the scourge of the town. They held people for criminal cases unless they paid them off, and they had collection rackets where the constable and magistrate shared in the recovery. They were an atrocity, and they had existed since Penn's Second Charter in 1691. And we reformed the system and got a constitutional amendment and put judges in the minor courts. And the relationship with Frank Rizzo is a part of the book. I first met Frank Rizzo when he was a police captain at 12th and Pine in a magistrate's court. And I walked in as a fledgling assistant DA, and Rizzo was always in charge, and he walked over and he threw her arm around me, and he said, "That's a nice suit you got on. Too bad they didn't have one in your size." And the next, this is a true story, Marie. On the next day, I walked into court, and he threw his arm around me. He goes, "That's a nice suit you got on today, too. Where'd you get it shined?" When I ran, those are the duller stories in the book. When I ran for district attorney, I ran on the Republican ticket. You probably haven't heard about the Republican ticket in Philadelphia elections. Nobody else has. But it was steep uphill. So we took a page out of the book of Joe Clark and Dick Dilworth, who ran against the Republican machine in 1949. And we got a flatbed truck, and we'd park it at 15th and Chestnut, illustratively, where a lot of people walked by during lunch. And I would, Jim Cavanaugh, who was running for controller, and I would stand up on the flatbed truck with a microphone on. And people would look up and say, "Who are those nuts? What's going on here? What are they talking about?" We did it at a lot of street corners and a lot of subway stops and a lot of factory gates. We made an impression, and that election was won. And one day I was on the corner making a speech, and Rizzo was in the audience, and afterwards he walked up and said, "You know, that was a tremendous speech you just made. And you had them in the palm of your hand. They were holding on every word. They were enraptured with what you had to say until the light changed." Frank and I had some more difficult moments. I believe I was the first DA in the country to arrest policemen for police brutality. And I did so only when the case was open and closed. But I always gave Police Commissioner Rizzo a chance to try to talk me out of it, which he never did, because when I had gotten to that stage, I was sure the evidence was very, very solid. And he would sit in my office sometimes for 2 hours, and he would say to me, "What do you expect? This felon in the stolen car is going the wrong way up a one-way street, driving 80 miles an hour. The policeman is pursuing him, putting his life in danger. The felon runs into a telephone pole, jumps out of the car, runs down an alley. The policeman follows him, putting his life in danger. The felon whirls with something shiny in his hand, and the policeman, in apparent self-defense, picks out his gun and shoots him. And it takes the Supreme Court 7 years to decide 5-4 the policeman was wrong. And now you want to arrest him." He made a pretty good argument, but as I said, I had worked these cases so that I was satisfied with them by the time I brought them in. And you may not be surprised to know that I never convicted policemen of police brutality. It wasn't that the juries doubted that there was police brutality, it's just that there wasn't enough of it. Juries were never very sympathetic to charges of police brutality. But those cases were very important to bring, and that was decades before Rodney King or profiling or you name it. The book also picks up in some substantial detail many of the activities in the Senate, where I chaired the Senate Intelligence Committee, and we investigated Khobar Towers, where 19 airmen were killed and 400 wounded, and the failure of the Secretary of Defense to follow intelligence and do the job that he should have done on warning them, or the Department of Defense lying to the Persian Gulf veterans who were exposed to chemicals, and they never told them the truth. And then there are the Supreme Court nominations, which constitute a very important part of the Senate function on advice and consent as to whether justices, the nominees of the president, should be confirmed. And one of my friends said to me, "Arlen, you're the The only guy I know who could alienate the entire electorate, half by leading the fight against Bork, and the other half by leading the fight for Clarence Thomas. But that was the way I saw those matters. The Bork hearings were really fascinating. Robert Bork was brilliant beyond any question, but he believed in original intent, and he thought he knew what the framers of the Constitution had in mind in 1787. I know I certainly didn't. And I met with him three times in my office, and on the hearings, finally, on the last Saturday, we had a very noteworthy session. And the day before, on Friday, Senator Biden, who was the chairman of the committee, announced that he was spending Saturday morning with his son's football game. He had his priorities right in order. So he was trying to assess how much time there would be for questions. And one of the senators wanted 10 minutes, another senator wanted 15 minutes, and then Joe Biden walked over to me and said, "Arlen, how much time do you want?" And I sat there, and he said, "Well, how much time do you want?" Finally said, "You want 30 minutes? I didn't say anything. "How about an hour?" And I didn't say anything. He said, "How about an hour and a half?" I said, "Okay, Joe, I'll take an hour and a half on Saturday morning." And then a couple minutes later, Senator Thurman, who was the ranking Republican, came over to me and said, "Arlen, what's this here? You want an hour and a half to question Bork? What's this about?" And I said, "No, Strom, that's not right. I don't want an hour and a half. I just want to question him until I'm finished." "Okay, you can have your hour and a half." And I did, and Judge Bork's view of original intent didn't take into account the values of an evolving society and what is important in America. And he did not believe in judicial review. And I was afraid that we'd wake up one morning and we'd find Brennan and Marshall and Blackmun deceased. And then you'd have Bork as a dominant force along with Rehnquist and Scalia. And where would judicial review be? And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, on a very, very deep subject, without judicial review, this would be a different country if you didn't have the courts as the final arbiter of what was going on. Attorney General Meese had made a speech that Tulane that the president had as much right to judicial review as the court, and Pat Robertson had given a long interview to the Post to the same effect, and that was a real danger, it seemed to me. The hearings on Justice Thomas were very, very difficult. I had no idea, when I was questioning Professor Hill, how painful it was for so many women who were watching the hearings, because there's a lot of sexual harassment in this world. And the women who were watching the hearings knew that they had been sexually harassed. And when Professor Hill's credibility was challenged, they thought almost that their credibility was being challenged by transference. But when you have a hearing and you're just about ready to confirm a nominee, and very, very late in the proceeding, these charges come up, you have to have an inquiry as to what the basis was. And what happened between Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, I don't know. The testimony was given in 1991 about an incident in 1981. Sometimes Joan and I have arguments and can't agree on what happened 10 minutes ago, let alone 10 years ago. But it seemed to me that on the totality of the circumstances, when she was willing to go with him from the Department of Education to the EEOC and called him up and drove him to the airport and invited him to a college in Oklahoma, that whatever happened was not so despicable as to be a disqualifier. I learned only fairly recently that Senator Biden shared my views about Professor Hill's credibility on this point. In writing the book, I went back and talked to a lot of people, talked to Gerald Ford, who was a commissioner, course, later president, talked to the autopsy surgeons, talked to the doctors at Parkland, talked to Clarence Thomas, tried to talk to Anita Hill, but she declined. And Senator Biden said that during the recess he sent word to Professor Hill that if she persisted in the answer that she had given, that he was going to pick up the line of questioning. I was on WHYY a couple of days ago talking about the book, and we only had 97% of the questions on Professor Hill, so that's still a point of some substantial contention, but if you're in the line of fire, sometimes you're fired upon. The book also picks up the issues of foreign policy. I have traveled extensively overseas. I believe that it's very important for senators to get to know people like Prime Minister Barak and Prime Minister Shamir and Prime Minister Netanyahu, and also President Assad of Syria, whom I met with on a dozen or more occasions, and President Mubarak of Egypt, and to try to work through the peace process. And that is a very, very grim prospect today. I spoke to the Zionist Organization of America on Sunday, and reviewed in some great detail where we're heading, and decided to introduce legislation which would condition any further aid to the Palestinians on their changing their textbooks. You'd find it hard to believe that they give fifth graders and seventh graders materials in school which talk about jihad and attack on Israel, with the goal being a martyr. And that parents let their 12-year-old sons go off to throw stones, running the risk of death on the theory that Allah's will be done. And if Allah has in mind that the boy should be killed in the stone-throwing, so be it. Now, that's a little incomprehensible to me, but I think that we have a generational problem there, really enormously, enormously difficult. And the book also takes up the issues of arms control and what we need to do about dealing with the strategic weapons. And essentially, the book expresses a great deal of concern for my four most important constituents, Sylvie, Perry, Lily, and Hattie Spector, our grandchildren. Well, I'm up to the 28-minute mark. They told me to speak between 30 and 40 minutes. I'm going to yield back the balance of my time, and I would be pleased to answer questions, and I would also be pleased not to answer questions.
Okay.
You don't need to stay there. In order that we have the information, as the Senator indicated, we do have recording for our archives. We do have microphones, and this is what many of you know, we do at all of our programs. So we'll have a microphone on each side of the room. If you'd like to ask the Senator a question, please raise your hand and I'll call upon you. Let's take a gentleman right here on the aisle. We'll be the first one.
Thank you. Arlen, in your book, you frequently mention some of your colleagues on the other side of the aisle. It's not a surprise, I'm sure, to hear that in the recent political campaign, Governor Bush spoke at great length about how he was going to build bridges to both sides. He was going to have bipartisanism. He was going to make it work differently than it has in the past. What is your view about bipartisanism in a possible Bush 2 administration?
I think that bipartisanship is indispensable to get anything done. I chair the subcommittee which funds the Departments of Education, Health, and Labor. It's a $106 billion budget we have. And I work very closely with Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa, because I learned a long time ago, if you want to get something done in Washington, you have to be willing to cross party lines. Governor Bush was derided for saying that he spent most of his time working with the opposite party in the legislature and in working with the press and in having photo ops. And working with the other side is very important. And working with the press is not very important. It's indispensable. If your message doesn't get out, they're the messenger. And on the photo ops, to the extent that means you're dealing with citizens groups, that's also very important. But we have a very difficult session coming up. At the last count, the tally was 50 Republicans and 49 Democrats, and Senator Gorton's seat in Washington is in the balance. And it may be that this will have a silver lining requiring the parties to work together. And the House has gone from 6-vote majority for Republicans to 3. And it is scandalous that Speaker Hastert and Minority Leader Gephardt don't talk to each other. Well, they don't make any bones about it. And they have been planning since the Congress started 2 years ago what the best way was to get their party in power. Well, we're not down there to stay in power. And sometimes we have to do things to take political risks. But bipartisanship is indispensable.
We have, if you can, you have a hand right there next to you. Okay, that'll be great. We'll do that, and then we'll come down. I had seen a hand up here. We'll do that one, and then take another one over there. Okay.
Senator Spector, first of all, thank you for this evening, and thank you for the many years of public service that you provided for this Commonwealth. You're an admirable example for young people throughout the United States today.
Thank you.
Given the, I hate to say results of the election yesterday, but given where the election has wound up, there's been a lot of discussion pertaining to the Electoral College. Is this a component of our government that needs to be changed, eliminated, and moved to the popular vote? I was wondering if you could comment on that, and also a concern that I have in seeing the Electoral College removed may be that a popular vote would create an environment in which campaigning would primarily take place in the large states of New York and California, Pennsylvania, and that the middle portions of America, the farm states, the prairie states, will not have the opportunity in the future, if there is just voting by popular vote, to get their issues brought to the national campaign level.
I believe that the provisions on the Electoral College ought to be changed, and I say that because the very fundamental of a democracy is majority rule, and one vote ought to be as good in one state as another. I do not think that there would be an appreciable difference in where the candidates went. They didn't spend a lot of time in Kansas for 4 or 5 electoral votes, and they won't spend a whole lot of time in Kansas for a state which has about 2.5 million people. But there's something that's just fundamentally wrong in having the popular vote go one way and the Electoral College go another. And the reasons for the Electoral College, which were valid in 1787, aren't valid today. I got a call from Angelo Gattaldi. I hate to bring up Angelo again. But Angelo called me with the same question, and I told him the same thing. And then I got a call from the TV stations. They wanted my position, so I spoke to the TV cameras. And I got a call from a friend today that one of the talk shows on 1210 had somebody call in and challenge my credentials as a Republican because I want to change the Electoral College. It apparently was considered unimportant that a change in the Electoral College wouldn't affect this election. It was on Dom Giordani's program. I'm sure you all listened to it. I'm going to call him tomorrow and give a spirited defense. Can you imagine someone challenging my Republican credential?
Yeah, we had if you come up, we have this question right here, and then we're going to go to one of the hands on the other side.
Arlen, based on your numerous meetings with President Assad, what do you think was the thinking? What is your best view of why President Clinton was not able to cinch a deal for the Golan Heights?
The question is, based on the meetings I had with President Assad, why was President Clinton unable to conclude a deal on the Golan Heights? President Assad was very, very finicky on everything. And I believe that Prime Minister Rabin, then in power, told President Clinton that he would be willing to give up the Golan Heights, subject to security considerations. And Assad simply wouldn't take yes for an answer. And he just wanted every last detail his own way. And I've complimented President Clinton both privately and publicly for the work he's done on the Mideast. I think he's gone the extra mile. It's really too bad that President Assad died, because I think eventually there would have been a deal. Assad did not trust Netanyahu, was a big factor after Rabin was assassinated. And I could tell you a lot more about that, but there are a lot of questions, and it is explained very thoroughly in the book.
Yeah. See, we had a hand over here.
Yes, I wanted to get back to the Electoral College. It seems to me that the Electoral College has the same similar impact on the states as having two senators in each state, regardless of their side. It does retain, not to the same degree, but it does actually have that effect. And I think I like the idea is what I'm getting at. Would you comment on that?
Sure. Well, it is true that small states like Montana or the Dakotas, which have two senators and one representative, get three votes in the Electoral College, so there is a little weighting in favor of the small states, and that is a factor. But I don't think it has led the candidates to go to North Dakota or South Dakota or Montana. Well, I think that's a good idea. One vote, okay. In Pennsylvania. Listen, I've got 12 million constituents. Senator Dorgan in North Dakota has 600,000 constituents. I think the 12 million have a lot more weight. And I don't like winner take all. Two states, Nebraska and Maine, divide them up. But I think we're dealing with something potentially very explosive in not having majority rule. This election looks like it's heading for the Electoral College winner to be Governor Bush, and the popular vote winner to be Vice President Gore. And I don't think that's a healthy thing. And I think when people start to focus on it, they're going to be very unhappy about it. I come back to basics, and the basic is majority rules. And we had a big Supreme Court decision during the Warren era. It was one man, one vote. I don't know how they got away with that instead of one person, one vote. But there you had weighted upstate, and the Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional. Well, it's not unconstitutional to have the Electoral College because it's in the Constitution, but the principle's the same. But each vote ought to have the same way.
Yes, we have a hand. Please raise your hands. I know that there's a hand right in the middle. Yep. But please, after each speaker, raise your hand high. So that after the answer, raise your hand high so that we can see you.
Yes, Senator Specter, assuming Governor Bush is our next president, what would be your two personal legislative priorities in the new Congress?
My legislative priorities are to keep maximum funding for the National Institutes of Health. Senator Harkin and I have made a special priority there, taking an institutes which had $12 billion for appropriation cycles ago and adding $8 billion where there are such remarkable breakthroughs on stem cell research and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and breast cancer. A priority that I have is crime control and fighting terrorism and arms control. I believe it's high time we had the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which is put into effect, has been bottled up in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with Senator Helms. I think arms control is really very, very important. And I have a couple of ideas germinating on the Supreme Court. The Constitution talks about advice and consent. Now all we do is consent on confirmation hearings. Senator Byrd has joined me in an idea to have a pool of 25 prospective Supreme Court jurors selected nationwide where we go into their qualifications instead of having all these people appointed from inside the Beltway. That's where they come from. But also I want the Supreme Court televised. I want people to know what the Supreme Court does. The Supreme Court today is a super, super legislature. That's also taken up in the book. And they declare acts of Congress unconstitutional on the grounds that they're not thought through. And as a lawyer and a member of Congress, I wonder who the Supreme Court is to decide these cases because they're not thought through. But I think the court's a wonderful institution. And they brought us Brown versus Board of Education. And where the political leaders in the executive and legislative branches have been fearful about advancing the cause of decency, the court has. But I think it ought to be done in the open. And I argued a case in the Supreme Court a few years ago, the Navy Yard case. And seven of the justices had been before the Judiciary Committee. And it was the fastest 30 minutes of my life. It was payback time. Lots of sport.
Okay. Please raise your hand high. Let's take this question here, and the next one will be right two-thirds of the way back.
Speaking of the Supreme Court, you were a strong supporter of Clarence Thomas. As you look back now on his record in the Supreme Court, do you have any second thoughts?
Question is, I was a strong supporter of Clarence Thomas. Looking back, do I have any second thoughts? Well, first of all, I was a supporter. I voted for him, but I was not a strong supporter. When President Bush said that Clarence Thomas was the best qualified, I publicly disagreed with him. When President Bush said that race was not a factor, I disagreed with him about that. Race was a factor, and I think an appropriate factor. I think you need diversity on the court. Was Clarence Thomas qualified for the Supreme Court? I think he was. Drew Days, the Solicitor General, who was very much opposed to his nomination, said he was qualified. He had gone to the Yale Law School. He was a Holy Cross graduate. He'd been a federal judge for only a short period of time, and I think he was qualified. And he has done a little better. I think he's got a ways to go, but he's done a little better.
All right. Now we have the question here,
Just to supplement that just a little bit,
sure.
You probably didn't know this, but I ran for president. And if I were making nominations, they'd be a lot different.
On that theme again.
The questioner is right there. Raise your hand so the senator can see you.
Yep. Right up here. I'm the small one. On the theme of the Supreme Court, if Governor Bush becomes our president, he said he was going to appoint more judges just like Anthony Scalia and Clarence Thomas. What is your comment?
Well, they have to be confirmed by the Senate.
And will they be?
Well, it depends on who they are and what they're like. Governor Bush has said he will not use a litmus test. He also said he's not going to try for a constitutional amendment to overturn Roe versus Wade. And I believe in a very active questioning of Supreme Court nominees. And I've done that all the way down the line. Whoever he puts up is going to have to pass muster before the Senate. I can't really tell you about the specifics, but I can say to you that whoever he puts up, I'll read all their writings and all their opinions if they've been judges, and go into their background and ask them all the questions. And if I think they're not qualified, if I think they're not good for the court, as I felt that about Bork, I'll stand up and say so. Pro-life? I'm not going to use a litmus test on the justices. I'm going to examine them on the totality of the circumstances. I don't think a litmus test is the way we do things in America.
Please raise your hand high. We have a question. One will be here, and then the next one will be right over there.
This is more in keeping with your own sense of what just took place in the last 24 hours or so, and where you personally feel that the constituency has moved towards. I got a sense that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with both candidates by a large segment of the constituency. Is that going to change the way government takes place over the next 4 years, do you think? Is there going to be a sea change with our representatives who may say to themselves, the people have spoken, we should be doing something about what we've just heard?
The question is, what do I think about the quality of the two men and what's likely to happen in the future? It is sort of a consistent pattern that voters in presidential elections don't like either candidate which come forward. That's not unusual. That happens really pretty much consistently. But a great problem is that the voters do not participate in the primary process. When I decided to undertake a very steep uphill battle for the Republican nomination, I knew that my position on the political spectrum was not going to be met with favor by most of the Republicans who participate in the primary process. But there are a lot of moderates in the Republican Party. There are a lot of pro-choice moderates. And I wanted to get them off the sidelines and onto the playing field, and I couldn't get that job done. And when we went to New Hampshire, and there were nine of us, I was the only applicant who wanted to keep the Department of Education. When I went to Iowa to speak before the Iowa State Committee, and I talked about Thomas Jefferson's doctrine of separation of church and state, I was booed. Booed when I talked about Thomas Jefferson, separation of church and state. If you want better people running, you got to get out there and fight it out in the primary process. The primaries are really dominated by both extremes of the political parties. Now, they don't necessarily produce the people whom you like. But one of the things that we really need is to try to dispel some of the cynicism. Whenever I talk to high schools and colleges, I urge the students to get involved, become committeemen, run for the state house. Run for the state senate. Run for the U.S. House of Representatives. Don't run for the United States Senate, but run for all those other offices. But that's what you have to do if you want better candidates to select from.
Okay. We have that hand, and then we'll catch you next.
Arlen, you said that you thought that there should be diversity on the Supreme Court. Well, when I saw the Republican convention, I saw basically a sea of white faces. And when I looked at the map, you know, of the electoral votes for Bush, I saw all of that red in the center of the country. And today when I heard the reporters on the radio and television, I heard the same thing, that basically the Republican Party or those who voted Republicans were white or white men. It seems as if the Republican Party is not as diverse, or there is not the kind of diversity that there is in the country. Is this so? And if it's so, do you think that it is a good or a bad thing? And how can we change it? What can we do to change this? Because the country is obviously white people are not going to be in the majority. And they're not.
The Republican Party is not as diverse as it should be, and I have made strenuous efforts to bring African Americans and Hispanics and minorities into my office. I had an activist program for hiring black lawyers. When I became DA, there were 550 black lawyers, and I called a lot of them personally and had all the rest of them call, and brought detectives in who were African Americans and Hispanics, and we need a lot more. There's no doubt about that. There's a very heavy tendency for the minorities to go to the Democratic Party, and it's a real battle. A very heavy tendency for the Jewish constituency to go to the Democratic Party, and that's another battle. And I think that Colin Powell really ought to be on the hustings as a role model to try to appeal to African Americans, but a lot more needs to be done on that subject, and the party is not as diverse as it should be by any means.
We had the hand right here towards the front in the middle.
Senator Spector, in the dialogues between both Senator Bush and Vice President Gore, both men have addressed the issue of education. And it seems as though both are saying that the way to improve our schools is through teacher accountability. I'm really curious to know whether in any of the discussions that have taken place in the Senate, whether the issue of student accountability has ever come up.
Question is whether student accountability comes up by contrast to teacher accountability. Sure, it does. It's a very big item on the agenda. Violence in the school system is an epidemic.
I'm talking about academic accountability.
Well, we do look to test scores. Well, how do you measure academic accountability?
I'd like to know whether or not students read the books that I assign.
Well, you'd like to know whether the students read the books that you assign? Well, I hope you do. You certainly have a better chance to know than I do. Well, the answer is yes.
Could you repeat that, excuse me, for other people?
In the Senate, do we discuss the role of the student in the classroom as well as the role of the teacher in the classroom? The answer is yes, we do. In what way do we do it? We do it in terms of test scores. There's a big debate. You don't like test scores? Well, how are we going to figure out whether they're studying and learning or whether they're not? We can't come into the classrooms, Well, no, you're not right about that. I say we can't come into the classrooms. I go to high schools, and I speak to college students, but I can't go into classrooms and make an appraisal. If you have a contrary suggestion, I'd be glad to hear it.
Well,
What? Well, I'll come to your classroom, and then I'm going to go to every other classroom in Pennsylvania, too.
We have,
We do go into the testing lines, and there's a big disagreement as to whether there ought to be national testing, with the Republicans opposed to it, the Democrats for it. And when you poo-poo the issue of violence or say that's not fundamental, before the students can learn anything, there's got to be a check on violence in the schools. And we've reallocated in my subcommittee more than $1 billion trying to move into the questions of parenting and psychological counseling and bring in the National Institute of Mental Health and bring in the parents and bring in a great many factors. So we are concerned about what goes on in the classrooms, but I wouldn't know how we could participate in the classrooms individually, but I'll take you up on your invitation. Let me have your name and phone number.
Okay. We had a hand that's been up, a person that's been quite patient in the back here, or in the middle.
Senator, let me ask you that if you felt in questioning Anita Hill, did you not validate her and give her credence by such rigorous questioning?
No. Who's got the next question?
Okay, let's go to the other side. Okay, let's have two more questions, and then we want to go upstairs and have an opportunity to sign books.
The question was whether I validated Professor Hill. I don't know quite what validating means, but I asked her questions as to what happened. I asked her questions as to what the specific conduct was of Clarence Thomas. And she'd given a statement to the Judiciary Committee on September 23rd of 1991, and when she came in to testify, her statement was substantially different. And I wanted to know why it had been added to. And I questioned her about her calls to Clarence Thomas when she came to town. I questioned her about why she asked Oral Roberts University to invite him to speak there, why she volunteered to drive him to the airport, and why she changed jobs after these acts allegedly occurred. And she had a reason which she didn't give, and that is he was sort of her mentor, the person who could vouch for her. We had to ask her those questions. When I was on the WHYY program, I got, as I said, 6 calls, and one of the questioners, I responded, I did not ask her any inappropriate questions or harsh questions. And I referred to the election I had where that was the principal challenge to my reelection in 1992. And I said to the caller, you want to go over the transcripts? I'll bring them up. But I saw him yesterday in my office, and he didn't want to go over the transcripts. I had the room set up and brought the tapes down, was all set to go over them. Those questions I thought were appropriate questions. The New York Times said I was painstakingly polite. I had one of my young woman lawyers go over the questions before last week, and a very astute young woman who had a different impression, she told me, and I don't think she was playing up to the boss when she looked at these questions and saw them as opposed to the feel she got when there were 14 white men with blue suits and red ties, checking my tie, and Anita Hill sitting by herself.
All right, we have one question right there, and then I think we ought to head on upstairs so that people can ask questions individually and get their books signed.
Senator Spector, is there any basis for dealing with the problem of the voters in Palm Beach who were confused in the poll booth?
Any way of dealing with them?
Is there any legal way? Is there any basis in the law? Or how do you think that will be?
Well, I don't know what the facts are about it, but We'd have to see exactly what happened. I don't think you can go back and have another vote. If you did that, it would be an endless process as to where you'd stop and where you'd start and where you'd stop. The judge in St. Louis who left the polls open, according to TV, for 3 extra hours, really sort of amazing. Missouri being a swing state, St. Louis being very strong on the Democratic side. These elections have imperfections, and even when I was DA, used to prosecute people for fraud, I could put the fraud actors in jail, but I couldn't undo what they had done for the election.
Ladies and gentlemen, we do want to give everybody a chance to buy books to get them signed. Let's thank Senator Stucker. Thank you very, very much.
Before you go, I was asked if I would personalize the books, and I said I would, and I was asked if I'd write Happy Birthday or Happy Hanukkah or Merry Christmas, and I said I'd do that. Elliot's trying to merchandise these books, and I want to help him. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.